I will not pretend to give Dave's talk in anything like the depth and excitement that he would have provided, but I will do my best to honor his slides. David Schimmel, for those of you who don't know the name, as Tom said, is with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. He's also been with the Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado in the past. And he's a longtime editor-in-chief of ESA's journal, Ecological Applications. I should say, for those of you who don't know us, ESA publishes six peer-reviewed journals. Two of them are open access. Ecological Applications is one of our subscription journals, which Dave is long-term editor for. Ecological Applications was established in the 1990s to publish applications of ecological science to environmental problems. It was ESA's venture into the world of applied ecology from an organization which had traditionally been focused on, essentially, on, quote, basic research. EA publishes papers that develop scientific principles to support environmental decision-making, along with papers that discuss the application of ecological concepts to environmental issues, policy, and management. And the principle about applications is that papers should be accessible both to scholars and practitioners. This is part of our organization's outreach to the practitioner world. So, Dave describes having worked under a NASA open data access policy since 1984, going back 30 years now. And he says that Dave has seen essentially no downside, that the community engaged with NASA science and data products is, quote, collaborative, productive, interactive, and nurturing of early career scientists. Another issue that sometimes has come up with respect to data sharing is its impact on early career scientists and data sharing essentially potentially getting scooped. Dave suggests that this is an inspiring example, excuse me, for environmental science from a field a lot closer to soil science, we hope, than the more biomedical examples. And again, the principles that are up on the slide from the NASA open data policy are that NASA plans and follows data acquisition policies that ensure the collection of long-term data sets for NASA's Earth Science program. NASA commits to full and open sharing of Earth science data obtained from NASA Earth observing satellites, suborbital platforms, and so forth as soon as the data become available. So NASA's principle is that the data are made available nearly in real time. It's not just a matter of linking it to publications. And they don't have a period of exclusive access to Earth science data, which I should note journals will often permit people even when we're requiring sharing of data. NASA makes available all of its standard products along with, as the gentleman just mentioned, the source code for algorithm software, coefficients, and ancillary data. And there's a link here, and these slides will be made available, I think, to the meeting post-meeting. So if folks want to find these policies in detail, the slides will be up there. So another example that can be cited, a more recent one, is the Landsat story. For those of you not familiar with the Landsat satellites, for many years after they were first launched, Landsat data were available at a cost from the U.S. Geological Survey. You had to pay for the data. And about 6 years ago, USGS made the very happy decision that Landsat data were going to be freely available from then on. They were going to put these out there. And this slide shows the growth of Landsat scenes, downloaded from the EROS Data Center, which oversees the Landsat program. Annual downloads went from thousands to millions in a year, leading towards on the order of nearly 25 million downloads now cumulatively. These scenes are used for science, management, policy, and other uses. Open data means high impact. And here is a case where a tremendously useful data sets were getting only modest use despite the millions of dollars they cost. Now that they're free, maybe not surprising, we have millions of access and far more productive use of the data. So with respect to ecological applications and our related journal Ecological Monographs, what is the open data policy that ESA has? And this expresses the formal policy. The editors and publisher expect authors to make the data underlying published articles available. Authors of manuscripts submitted to Ecological Monographs, which led off this effort, as of January 1st, 2011, and manuscripts submitted to applications as of January 1st, 2014, about 2 years ago. are required to make available all the data associated with the results in a permanently publicly accessible data archive or repository once the manuscript is accepted. I should note that that is two out of our six journals. We haven't pushed forward policies for the other four journals, which I hope will happen, but we have made a good beginning. Why would we do this, and why would an author deposit their data and choose open data? And that relates back a little bit to some of the discussion of the benefits that I described in quote, my talk. First, visibility. Making your data available online, linking to the publication, provides a new pathway for other people to learn about your work. People are not just interested in your words, but in your numbers, if I can put it that way. Citability. All the data you deposit, at least in a repository that does this, will receive a persistent, resolvable identifier, whether it's a digital object identifier or some other permanent identifier. The fact is, linking your data with an identifier means that you can list it in your CV, you can put it in citations, and it can be discoverable on the web. It's not just a matter of looking for keywords and so forth. You've got this permanent identifier out there linked to your paper, so that is cited in your paper, people can find the data. Workload reduction. If you're really popular and people really want your data a lot, all you have to do is refer them to files in the archive, or it's listed in your paper. You don't have to spend your time responding to individual requests for different data sets or different subsets of data. Again, preservation. Computers fail, we lose things. People leave theses and taxicabs, all kinds of things. Your data files be permanently and safely archived in perpetuity. And finally, impact. If data can be cited, that increases your likelihood of being cited, not just for the data, not just for your papers, but for the data themselves. So some emerging imperatives, and I should note that these photographs, as Dave pointed out to me, are actually covers, recent covers from Ecological Applications. So these are based on real articles. Replication. Why does the journal care? A lot of ecological studies, as I mentioned in my own talk, are essentially unreproducible in the sense that a laboratory experiment is, because in field experiments you'll never see exactly the same conditions. I think this is true in agriculture too. You can replicate your plots over and over again, but you're never going to see exactly the same moisture conditions, weather conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you want to at least be able to reproduce calculations and analyses, you need access to the raw data. You can't simply go to the methods section, follow the methods, and come up with the same equivalent data. That would be a different kind of exercise, though still a useful one. And then finally, there's a growing recognition that data need to be transparent, that when the stakes are high, particularly in controversial issues, the parties ought to have access to the underlying data to either convince themselves, explore alternate hypotheses, and so forth. And even just deciding and saying publicly that data are not available can set you up for conflicts that do not help advance your cause. So open data is increasingly important to the peer review process. As Dave, as a journal editor, points out, requiring all data to be made available to peer reviewers, even when otherwise protected, should be a matter of non-negotiable policy. The reviewers ought to have access to the data, even if they're not necessarily going to go in and check each individual point. I'd also point out as a side issue that there are several data journals that are springing up which are directly reviews of data. And ESA itself, those of you who may have heard Bill Michener speak on Monday morning, we'll be aware that ESA has essentially a data journal called Ecological Archives, which Bill edits, which offers people the opportunity to contribute data sets without having to write them up and make them available. And again, those have to be peer-reviewed. It's not just a matter of dumping it into a location someplace. Peer reviewers are increasingly, though not often, asking to review underlying data for papers. And so as a consequence, leading to the conclusion, data review is becoming a more important part of the peer review process. So a couple of examples of where people have gotten in trouble, perhaps, over not sharing data. And you may recognize that the sources of these quotes are not from mainstream research people. Minor increases in the world's surface temperature data, which is admittedly, quote, adjusted by governments for various reasons, has been key to demanding global policies restricting carbon emissions and economic freedom to supposedly fight climate change. Data not readily made available to the public should not be given one iota of credit, period. These two quotes are both from skepticalclimate.org, an organization of climate skeptics not given to promoting the concerns of climate change, but making the important point that not sharing data just raises the stakes in such arguments. And Dave told me that he speaks as one of the people who was caught up in the great Climate Gate event several years ago, and so he very much appreciates the importance of making the data available. He also points out that issue of adjustments in data, things like that, raise the related issues of open code and algorithms, as adjusted data showing that for issues of policy and management, open data and code can head off lines of unproductive conflict. And I think there's a key word that are in Dave's notes, unproductive conflict. It's all very fine to have scientific disagreement. That's an important part of how we progress. But unproductive conflict resulting from our unwillingness to share the data and the mechanisms by which we arrive at our conclusions is a different question. So some hot issues that get addressed by authors of ecological applications that are not just climate change, but other kinds of things where Dave says that we need open data policies. U.S. wildfire management policy is a huge issue, certainly particularly in the West these days. Conservation of the prairie chicken, management of marine protected areas, management of West Nile virus, a concern particularly to those of us in the East. For you folks, soil management, nitrogen transport, and effects on marine dead zones. Impacts of herbicides on amphibian decline. The Deepwater Horizon event, where a lot of data in the ecological community was made available very, very early on by actually a coalition of our graduate students who got together and dug up data and posted it to publicly available places. But of course, there were other issues about ExxonMobil's willingness to make public the data that they were collecting. Ecological impacts of tar sands exploitation, in Canada, and related to that, the recent discussions about the KXL pipeline, and a lot of others. Papers in any of these areas can generate the need or demands for all sides to have access to the underlying information. I will quote Dave from a telephone conversation the other day, that it's simply not acceptable anymore to just say that the information is in a peer-reviewed journal. We need the other parts of the process to be open too. So what are the downsides to this, which we all get concerned about, including ESA? As I say, I would come back and say, we're talking about two of our six journals so far, not all of them. We do make exceptions under policy for legally shielded data, like that on endangered species. We don't want to disclose the precise location of the last three examples of an endangered plant for collectors to go find, or from government data sources that might be protected for commercial or ethical reasons. Dave indicates that what they provide is a metadata-based solution. That is, they provide a means that a researcher can make the same data request, say from a government agency, to obtain it independently themselves rather than from an open source, and certain types of process data that can allow replication of key calculations. Negative career impacts about getting scooped, Dave suggests, appear to be largely a myth or an urban legend. Dave said that in his searches they've not been able to find a single well-documented case where that's been an issue, and there are lots of cases where making data available has increased citation, provided new funding opportunities, collaborations, so basically dismisses that particular argument. So how do we archive data? I mentioned a few in my talk earlier. Here are some examples where that are used for people submitting articles to the ESA journals. Dryad, I mentioned before, which is an inexpensive and convenient service that partners with ESA. Carol Tenapier is on their board and I think can give you more information after the talk if you want to hear more about Dryad. Online appendices, which I think virtually all publishers use, work for small data sets but not for the increasingly large ones that people are generating. And there are a lot of agency-supported data repositories. I mentioned GenBank. There's the NASA DAX, and I never remember what the acronym is, but NASA has its own data archives available. Long-Term Ecological Research Program makes its data available virtually in real time and widely available in the world data centers. And as the gentleman brought up earlier, increasingly university libraries are supporting their faculty with persistent and searchable data resources. So, conclusions. Open data is coming. The funders and the sponsors, as we mentioned earlier in this conversation, are increasingly demanding open data. It raises a lot of issues, including things like legally shielded data, level of effort by the author, which we want to keep simple, and the lack of readiness in some science areas. I would note that Mike Whitlock, the former editor of American Naturalist, came up some years ago with what he called the 15-minute rule for data archives, and that is, if it takes any longer than 15 minutes to upload your data, then we need a different system, that we need to make it easy. And Mike has followed that up by having helped establish mandatory data archiving for American Naturalist and promoted it for a number of other evolution journals. Open data is increasingly an essential and extremely aspect of scientific credibility. Again, this is starting to sound a little bit like the same talk again. And it's an important responsibility of the scientific community as a whole, publication chain, authors, reviewers, editors, and the journals. And Dave sends his thanks and his regrets, and I thank you. And I'll do my best to answer questions, but I'm not the editor.
Thank you for your talk. Sometimes sometimes contractors get a hold of information and they submit work to the federal agencies. Okay, I'm going to specify the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Submitted their full report to the Federal Energy Regulation Commission. Oddly enough, even though it's a section that they were required to perform soil science work, evaluate the literature with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and then actually physically go out into the field and take soil samples. They did not. Yet, they submitted their information to the Forest Service and to the Federal Energy Regulation Commission that their report was complete. So they violated the agreement by not submitting real data.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to go in and review their work even more than I already have, how do I ask them, you're submitting something to a federal regulation or a regulator, what kind of words would I say to say I want to review the data that you're submitting? How do I do, and am I allowed to? I mean, do I have a right to say what data are you submitting to the federal government?
I don't know, actually. I would hope so. I used to be a contractor, and so I'm sympathetic to that. And I used to write National Environmental Policy Act documents for a living and believe very strongly that we ought to make whatever data we're collecting available. The data are paid for by the taxpayers, particularly for regulatory decisions. I don't know. I guess my speculation, I don't know if there's anybody better versed in the law than I am, here, whether the Freedom of Information Act might possibly give force action on that. That would be my first thought, but I don't know the legalities. In the back?
Yeah, so I really appreciate the fact that you say you need to make it easy to upload data, the 15-minute rule. That's great. But at the same time, you need to balance that with annotations and descriptions and metadata that makes the data make sense.
Yep. The applications does not, in my understanding, get into that level of detail. It's more a matter of the editor or the managing editor at ESA will make a determination about whether a given repository is an acceptable place. Dryad is by default because we have a financial arrangement with them, but there are lots of other ones that are plausible. And I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think it more feeds back into the requirements of the particular archive. ESA does not get into the particular details of the metadata formats, things like that. If it's acceptable to the archive and the archive is acceptable to us, then that's where we work out the balance. Does that begin to answer your question?
Okay, so the journal itself will just accept other people's standards wherever the repository resides.
Right, yeah. And if somebody comes up with an archive that we're not familiar with, then presumably the editor-in-chief or our publications director would investigate and find out if that was something that would be acceptable to this society. Here.
Could you just step through the process of reviewing a data, the set of data that can go into a data repository? You said that they're being increasingly reviewed. What's the basis for the review? How that?
I'm going to duck that question, not because I don't think it's important, but because I'm not familiar with the basic process. I wish Bill Michener had been able to stay another couple of days because he actually runs that process for us. But I can tell you that there is an established set of practices for doing that at ESA, and I've not read through them, but the rise of recent data journals, I'm sure, are using a standard set of practices. I would imagine Stephanie might have insight. Thanks. Is that right?
I actually have two questions. The first is, if there are people that are sort of leery of providing their data, do you think that will impact the number of publications in journals that require you to give that data?
The question is, which has come up in ESA governing board meetings, among other places, is as to whether requiring data archiving in journals will affect submissions to the journals. And that is something that was discussed at length by our governing board when we first started exploring this as a concern. In fact, it has not affected the numbers, but it is a commonly expressed concern, and I'm sure if the society's representative were to get into that, that's going to be part of your conversation. But I don't think it's been our experience or the evolution journals. Dryad has a group of journals who have all signed onto something called the Joint Data Archiving Policy, the JDAP, which encompasses at least half a dozen evolution journals and a number of others who all require data archiving. And I don't think it's affected their submissions or the quality of their publications at all. Other question?
Yeah, my second question is there like a standardized
Again, the journals are not requiring that. That's something that would be a matter of negotiation between the particular archive and the researcher. We're simply identifying to make sure that archives are going to be persistent, discoverable, accessible. Your archive can't be your website, that sort of thing. It needs to be findable. It needs to have some evidence that it will last, into the future. Nothing is forever necessarily. So the very short answer is no, at least on the part of the publishers. There's. Well, thank you for your patience. Oh, I'm sorry. You mean in terms of the, whether you can find out like who's using it or how many?
Or just that you've been notified that it hasn't been accessed or anything like that?
I believe so, yeah. Carol is nodding her head, yes. Yeah, you can get that kind of...
Some do and some don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, people want to know if their data are being noticed at all. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.